From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, Brendan Dassey from Making a Murderer is petitioning Governor Evers for clemency, even though his case may not meet the criteria for eligibility.
The authority that makes the rules can amend the rules. Enlightened authorities learn through experience and often do amend rules. This is a really, really unique and uniquely compelling circumstance.
Then activist Cleve Jones talks about what it was like working in San Francisco during the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. And Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour dazzles us with his music. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. In 2015, the documentary series Making a Murderer reached millions of viewers around the world. The series tells the story of Stephen Avery and his nephew, Brendan Dassey, both convicted of murdering Teresa Halbach in Manitowoc County. Dassey was just a teenager when he was sentenced to life in prison. And the series raises a lot of questions about Dassey's conviction, which largely hinged on his confession, a confession that his legal team says was coerced. Seth Waxman is a member of that legal team. Waxman is also the former Solicitor General for the United States, and he joins me now in studio. Seth, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
I'm so honored to be part of the Lake Effect.
I was talking to a lot of people about actually this upcoming interview, and they went, oh, I don't really know anything about this case. So to really just start here, can you give us kind of a timeline of what's happened in this case?
You know, essentially there was a horrible murder of a young woman in a rural county in Wisconsin. You know, the premise of the show is that the accused was somebody who had previously served many, many years in prison for an assault, an aggravated rape that it turns out he didn't commit. There had been a documentary film crew, two women from New York, who had come out to do a documentary about that wrongful conviction, and a subsequent civil suit that this man, Stephen Avery, had brought against the local sheriff's office and the local prosecutor based on evidence that was revealed that they, in fact, had a lead on the person who actually was subsequently confessed to being the rapist but didn't follow it because there was a local grudge. And it just so happened that they were done filming and were packing up to go back to New York when this man, Stephen Avery, was arrested for the mutilation and murder of Teresa Halbach. Brendan Dassey was a nephew of Stephen Avery. He was 16 years old at the time. He is borderline intellectually disabled. He was in special education classes and had been tested. Tests had shown that his language comprehension skills were at the lowest percentile, which means that 99 out of every 100 kids could understand things and communicate better than he could. He was not initially a suspect in the case, but several months after Stephen Avery had been arrested and charges had been filed against him, the police said that they had heard from a relative of Mr. Avery and Brendan Dassey that Brendan had lost a lot of weight, that he had been crying a lot since the arrest of his uncle. And the police decided to interrogate him. And over the course of 48 hours, did four two-on-one interrogations of him without a parent, without a lawyer. The last one was in the police station. It was a three-hour videotaped interrogation session in which the police, after patting him on the knee and telling him that they were police officers, but they were also fathers and they were really talking to him as a friend, proceeded to ask this disabled juvenile 1,500 questions in 3 hours. Once he agreed with a highly inculpatory account of a murder, he then asked whether he could go back to school in time for the sixth hour because he had a project to prepare. And they then said, well, we're police officers and you can't go back to school. And he said, well, can I go tomorrow? They said no, all on videotape. And then his mother came in to talk to him, and he immediately told his mother that he hadn't done anything wrong. And she said, well, why do they think they did? And you can see him on the videotape say, they got into my head. He was tried and convicted in front of a local jury in a case in which there was no physical evidence tying him to the scene of the crime, to Teresa Halbach, to anything in the case. And so a question arose, obviously, upon his conviction. Why did the jury convict him? The answer, I think, the only answer that makes any sense is the prosecutor's closing argument in the case. The prosecutor, in effect, told the jury, when you go into the jury box to consider the guilt or innocence of Brendan Dassey, you bring your common sense with you. And when you apply your common sense, you know that someone who is innocent does not confess to being guilty. That statement that innocent people don't confess is actually wrong. There are decades of scientific studies, forensic studies, and evidence arising from now hundreds and thousands of exoneration cases where a conviction was obtained on a confession that prove that for a variety of different reasons, people who may be innocent in fact do confess. And that phenomenon is particularly true for juveniles, juvenile boys in particular, who are in police custody, for people with intellectual disabilities. It is massively true for people who have a reduced capacity to be able to either communicate or process language. And so the predicate on which the jury was told to apply its common sense was wrong.
You know, there was a very large group of people who wanted to see this case revisited at the very least. In 2016, a judge, it's my understanding, threw out Dassey's conviction and ruled that he should be released while prosecutors appealed the decision. But of course, he wasn't released. What happened there?
So there's a conviction. It's appealed to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, which affirmed the conviction on the grounds that it could not conclude that as a matter of law, his confession was involuntary. So the only avenue of relief for Brendan Dassey was to file a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in federal court. And there are federal laws that govern the circumscribed circumstances under which a federal court can determine that a state court conviction was so clearly violative of the U.S. Constitution that it can order the conviction reversed. A petition was filed in federal district court here in Milwaukee. A federal district judge heard a lot of evidence in the case and rendered a decision that's, if memory serves me, is about 150 pages long, analyzing all the evidence in the case and concluding that applying the standards of the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, no reasonable judge could possibly conclude that that confession was not the product of coercion under all the circumstances of the case, including his age, his mental impairments, his intellectual impairments, his language impairments, and the circumstances of this concentrated series of uncounseled police interrogations. And he ordered that Dassey be released or given a new trial. The state appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal court of appeals that has jurisdiction over all cases arising out of, among other places, Wisconsin, Illinois. A panel of the Seventh Circuit heard the case and ruled 2-1 that the district court was correct. The conviction represented a gross miscarriage of justice, and that beyond any possible doubt, the confession was not voluntary and had been the subject of coercion. The state asked the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to rehear the case en banc, which means all active judges will hear the case, and the court agreed. Between the time that the court agreed to hear the case and the time that it decided the case, two active judges on the court became ineligible to participate. The full court heard argument again and ruled 4-3 that a writ of habeas corpus should not issue.
So now you're asking Governor Evers for clemency. Does he have any other options? Does Dassey have any other options?
As things now stand, no. Typically, somebody who's charged with a crime has a constitutional right to a trial. You have a constitutional right to an appeal. You have a right under federal law and the federal constitution to have a federal court test the constitutionality of your conviction and imprisonment, which he has availed himself of. He won in the district court. He won before a Seventh Circuit panel. He lost before the en banc court. And I was unsuccessful in convincing the Supreme Court to accept review of his case, which means that his judgment of conviction is final and he no longer has any currently available means of legal relief. And so we are asking the governor to pardon him or at the very minimum to commute his sentence to time served because he is in fact innocent. I think one thing that people may not realize is that through all these multiple levels of judicial review, not a single judge has ever expressed the view or even suggested that Brendan Dassey is in fact not innocent, that his confession was not in fact coerced. Millions and millions of people know what this case stands for. Millions and millions of people know this is a conviction that upon reflection of all the facts and circumstances should not stand, and that this boy is at a minimum very probably completely innocent. And therefore, I think in part because of the starkness of the case and because there is no evidence against him except this videotaped confession, an individual who in the intervening, I guess, 13 or 14 years has been a model prisoner, by all accounts, the sweetest disposition. If there were ever a case for the application of executive clemency, it's this. I mean, I just don't know what more could be presented to the governor and how important it would be for him to say, yes, this is the model of the kind of case for which the president in the federal system and governors in the state system have the power and authority and duty to apply clemency in an appropriate case.
When you look at this case, it seems like Brendan Dassey has fallen through a lot of different cracks, in part because people continue to read the law as something that's very black and white, and he fits into kind of a gray area. That being said, Governor Evers has said that he's not considering anyone who is either still serving their prison sentence or he's not issuing any commutations. He's also said that these criteria cannot be waived. What are the odds of succeeding here when we have a governor who's been very clear about the kinds of cases he's willing to look at and the kinds he's not?
So again, I'm not the best authority here, but I have not understood the governor in the rules and guidelines that he's proposed to take commutation off the table at all. And I would also say that I don't understand, while the governor's current rules do not appear to have an exception for cases of actual innocence, as the Supreme Court and many, virtually every court and every chief executive has recognized, actual innocence is in a class of one. I don't know whether the governor has been presented with a clemency petition for pardon or commutation of somebody as to whom the evidence of actual innocence is so compelling. The governor created whatever rules he thought were appropriate at the time that he took office. I'm sure that he and his board have had experience applying those rules. The authority that makes the rules can amend the rules. Enlightened authorities learn through experience and often do amend rules. This is a really, really unique and uniquely compelling circumstance. And so I hope and I pray that whatever the governor has said, whatever guidelines he has announced on a going forward basis, will either be flexible enough to grant clemency in this case or will present a sufficiently compelling case that the governor will see fit to amend and modify his rules so that he can do so without contravening the guidelines that he set forth. I mean, clemency is ultimately, historically, going back to prehistory, a circumstance very individualized. It depends utterly on the case that's presented and the equities and the pros and cons. It has always been the case that there would be rules and guidelines that would apply in the vast majority of cases, in the mine run of cases. But every once in a while, you know, human beings and human institutions and human circumstances being what they are, every once in a while something truly exceptional will present itself. And this is something truly exceptional.
You talked a lot about the interrogation, of course, and that was really, it seems like one of the first things that drew you into this case, the transcripts from that interrogation. What was it about that that made you want to become a part of this legal team?
Well, I mean, most immediately, I had handled a case in the Supreme Court called Roper versus Simmons, in which the Supreme Court for the first time declared that the execution of juvenile offenders violated the Eighth Amendment. A lot of the advocacy in that case involved marshaling medical evidence and biological evidence about how the juvenile brain develops and how late parts of the brain, particularly for boys, develops that allow them to evaluate medium-term risks and consequences. As a result of that, I got involved in a couple of cases in the Supreme Court that established the respects in which the execution of persons with intellectual disabilities also violated the cruel and unusual punishment clause. And so I had become interested and somewhat involved in my pro bono practice in representing death row inmates who were either juveniles or had some level of intellectual disability. I mean, more generally, I began practicing law in 1978 and have tried to spend at least 20% of my time doing pro bono representation of respects in which I thought I could help make the world a better place. And since 1978, that has included representing death row inmates in their post-conviction proceedings. One of the first cases I tried was a habeas trial for a death row inmate in Georgia. And those are tough cases. You know, you can't win them all, to say the least. When somebody's life is at stake, it's a great responsibility. And what I've said to people, and it's true, is I've never had a case that has troubled me as much as this one. I felt like when the Supreme Court denied review of this case, I felt like this just bottomless sadness that I couldn't help Brendan Dassey in a way that I've not felt in other cases that I've handled for people who were serving horrible sentences, or frankly, in years of representing the interests of the United States in cases that I thought were really, really important to the health and well-being of our country. this case has just stayed with me in a way that is really, really unique, and it's the reason that I'm in Wisconsin today.
Yeah. Well, Seth Waxman, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Seth Waxman is a former Solicitor General for the United States who served during the Clinton administration. Waxman is part of the legal team representing Brendan Dassey, one of the subjects featured in the Netflix documentary series Making a Murderer. We'll take a short break, and then we're joined by AIDS and LGBT rights activist Cleve Jones, the man who started the AIDS Memorial Quilt. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In the early 1980s, formerly healthy gay men started to develop an unknown disease. Men started dying, and what started as a few men skyrocketed into thousands. Communities in New York, San Francisco, and other U.S. cities were decimated. Cleve Jones was there. Jones started his work in advocacy as an intern for gay rights leader Harvey Milk. After Milk was assassinated, Jones began his work in public health. He is perhaps most well known as the person who came up with the idea for the AIDS Memorial Quilt, the largest piece of community folk art in the world. And Jones is not just an activist. He was diagnosed with HIV in the early 80s and has been living with AIDS for more than two decades. Jones is one of the co-chairs for this year's AIDS Walk Wisconsin and 5K, which will be this Saturday at the Summerfest grounds. He joins us by phone to talk about his work. Cleve Jones, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm very excited to be coming back to Wisconsin to be one of the co-chairs of the 30th anniversary AIDS Walk Wisconsin and 5K run.
Yeah. So I want to take like a big step back, kind of in your timeline. How did you first become involved with the gay rights movement in general?
Well, when I was still a teenager, I hitchhiked up to San Francisco from Phoenix, and I met, just by chance, I met some of the real pioneers of our movement. And one of them was a man that most people have heard of now, named Harvey Milk. And Harvey mentored me and took me with him to City Hall when he got elected to the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. And I worked with him until he was assassinated in November of 1978. And after that, I was hired by the Speaker of the California State Assembly to go to our capital, Sacramento, and work primarily on health issues. And it was in that capacity that I first got involved with the fight against what we now call HIV/AIDS.
So you were really on the front lines of this issue. What was it like right at the beginning?
You know, I think it's important for people to remember what it was like during the first decade of our fight against this disease. We had no effective treatment. We had a government that was not particularly concerned. There was a lot of stigma, a lot of bigotry, a lot of really hateful and ignorant behavior. And people suffered. And in my town, San Francisco, during that decade and a half before effective treatments were made available, over 20,000 of our citizens were killed by the disease. And in my community, it was really, it was like an avalanche came through and took everybody away. It was terrible.
You yourself are positive. When did you first learn that you'd contracted this disease?
By the time the test was developed, the HIV antibody test, I had already imagined that I was HIV positive simply because one of my partners had was one of the first to die of the disease in our city. But I found out the very week that the test became available. And it's kind of interesting because I had participated in a study. And there were samples of my blood going back many, many years. And I learned that the virus had been in my body since 1977. But I didn't show any symptoms and begin to get sick until 1993. So I think I'm an example of someone who can have the virus without even knowing it or having any signs of it for a very, very long time. But then eventually I did get very sick, almost died, and I'm only alive today because the activists and the scientists and the research were successful in pushing for more funding and getting the drugs available.
Yeah. I mean, you yourself said that you weren't that surprised that you had it, but what was getting that diagnosis like in the early 80s?
It was a death sentence. I never gave up hope, though. And I was fortunate. Unlike many people, my family did not reject me. My church did not reject me. My friends supported me. But I'm a realistic person, and I knew there was very little chance that I was going to survive it. The hardest part of it was getting the courage to tell my mom and dad and my grandmother, who I was very close to my grandmothers, and telling them was probably the most difficult part of the whole experience.
Yeah. I think many people may know you as the person who came up with the idea for the AIDS Memorial Quilt. When did you conceive of that idea?
Well, every year on November 27th, in San Francisco, we hold a candlelight march to remember Harvey Milk and our former mayor, George Moscone, who were both assassinated back in 1978. And in 1985, as we were holding that march, getting ready for the march, the death toll from AIDS in San Francisco hit 1,000. And I knew a great many of those first 1,000 because I'd been, so involved in the community. And, I was just really struck by that number and the fact that there was so little evidence. And if you come to Castro Street today, you'll see beautiful Victorians, just like it was then, and restaurants and bars and cafes. You'll hear music and smell food and hear laughter, and you'll have no idea that you are at the epicenter of this terrible tragedy. And I got so frustrated by it and the lack of concern, and I wanted to illustrate how many people had died. So in that march, I had everybody carry signs on which we'd printed the names of our friends and neighbors who had passed from AIDS. And we went to the federal building and climbed up ladders and taped all of these names all over the wall of the federal building. And as I was looking at that patchwork of names, I thought it looked like some kind of strange quilt. And I thought of my grandmothers and the quilts that they'd made. And it was such a comforting and middle American traditional values kind of symbol, and I want traditional family values to apply to me and my extended family. And that was the idea. And everybody laughed at me. I became quite boring because all I could talk about for a whole year was this idea. And finally, some friends of mine helped me start, and it became the world's largest community arts project.
When you first saw this project after its completion, what did you think?
We unfolded for the first time on the National Mall in October of 1987 with 1,920 panels. And I was just overwhelmed by the beauty of it. I knew it would help people cope with their grief, right? I hoped it would help people cope with their grief. I felt it would be a great tool to help the media understand that behind all these mind-numbing numbers and statistics, there are human beings and human families that are enduring terrible suffering. But I was not prepared for the beauty of the thing, and it really took my breath away, and I felt so proud of all of our volunteers. And then it just kept growing and growing and growing. The last time it was displayed in its entirety, we covered the entire National Mall from the steps of the Capitol to the Washington Monument, and that was an extraordinary sight.
Yeah. What do you think of it when you see it now compared to, of course, when it was first created?
It just reminds me of how far we've come. And everywhere I've been, I've seen evidence of the incredible progress that's been made. And when you look at organizations like the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin and the agency in San Francisco that I helped start in San Francisco, country and around the world, at the beginning by volunteers who understood that the government wasn't, their governments weren't moving rapidly enough. And then to see over the years how these services have grown and become more sophisticated, and the technology that we have to fight the disease has grown. So one of the reasons why I'm really happy to be part of these upcoming events with the AIDS Resource Center is that even though we don't have a cure yet or a vaccine, we have the ability to stop AIDS. And that's what is happening in Wisconsin and other places where people have really pushed for treatment as prevention. So when a client of the AIDS Resource Center goes into for an appointment in Milwaukee or wherever, they're going to get, if they're HIV negative, they're going to get the counseling, support, the information and the resources they need to stay HIV negative. And if they're HIV positive, they're going to get the medications that will suppress the virus to keep them healthy and also to ensure that they cannot transmit the virus. So what we now know is that people like myself who are being successfully treated are not capable of passing on the virus. And that's why the AIDS Walk and other events like that are so important, because that provides funding that allows the Resource Center to make these services available and get people into treatment and stop the disease. In San Francisco, we just got really amazing new numbers that last year, under 200 new infections were reported. That's down from 2,300 not so long ago. And in Wisconsin, we see that people with HIV are living longer than almost anywhere else in the world. And that is the kind of progress that we know we can make, but we can't falter. And one of the things that concerns me is that so many people think that the AIDS pandemic is over. It's not over. 700,000 people died of AIDS around the world last year. So that's why organizations like the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin are really critically important and need to be supported by their communities.
You know, as you say, so much has changed with how HIV/AIDS is treated, how it's looked at in many ways, but it isn't perfect. What needs to change?
We all know that we still don't have a vaccine or a cure. I believe someday we will have that. And one of my personal goals is to live long enough to see that happy day come. We can't let our education efforts wind down. Young people are still making decisions every day that affect their health. We need them to understand the risks of HIV. We need them to know exactly how it is transmitted, how they can protect themselves and their loved ones. So, in many ways, you know, the issues have been pretty constant. There is a resistance in some parts of the country to providing young people with those tools that they need to stay safe, to stay healthy. And we need funding. And I know that, you know, communities all across the country, and believe me, I'm still traveling a lot, and I see firsthand the really heroic efforts that people are engaged in. But the funding is not always keeping up with the needs. And it's regrettable that things like AIDS Walk Wisconsin are even necessary. In a perfect world, we wouldn't have to be going out and doing this kind of fundraising. The resources would be there, but we have to do it.
Yeah. Well, Cleve Jones, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing so much of your work.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm looking forward to coming back. As I mentioned, I travel constantly, and I have visited so many of these agencies. And in my opinion, the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin is, without question, one of the absolute best I've ever seen. So I'm happy to be supporting them and look forward to getting back soon. Thank you.
Cleve Jones is an AIDS and LGBT rights activist. He's the co-founder of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and he conceived the idea for the AIDS Memorial Quilt. Jones is also one of this year's honorary co-chairs for AIDS Walk Wisconsin. The walk and 5K run will be this Saturday, October 5th, at the Summerfest grounds. We'll take one last break, and then Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour performs for us in Studio C. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. more of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour signed with Milwaukee's Candy Rat Records in 2005, before the label was actually open for business. He remains one of its most popular artists and has released 6 albums, 2 DVDs, and has more than 50 million views on YouTube. Dufour, who is based in Montreal, was in town last month performing and teaching at UWM's fingerstyle guitar program. He stopped by our studio to share some music and chat with Bonnie North. He starts with his own composition called These Moments.
These Moments, Antoine Dufour in Lake Effect's performance studio. Merci beaucoup.
Oh, merci.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, you are one of my favorite guitarists. So when the opportunity came to have you in the studio, I could not say no.
Wow, so, such an honor.
Yeah, it's well, you know, you play so beautifully, and I just love the textures that you get from the guitar. You manage to find all these different sounds and different shapes of sound within it. When did you first start playing? Were you one of those child prodigies?
No, actually, no? Not at all. I started, I was 15 years old. Yeah. My dad was playing a little bit of guitar, so he showed me a few chords. I've learned my first songs, very simple things. And 2 years after, I started being interested in some classical stuff. Well, through a progressive rock band called Yes, there's this Steve Howe guitar player there, and he was playing this song called Mood for a Day. It's kind of a classical feel to it. And then at the time, I didn't know how to play that stuff, so I would pick my guitar and, you know, I learned it all the way through. I was able to play it with the recording, sync with the recording. But at the time, I was just playing with my thumb and index of my right hand. And anyways, I got to be able to do it. Then I applied in college for actually a double program, which was a music and also pure sciences. It's like a 3-year program we have in Quebec. The system is a little different over there, but we have. So I've been studying the two things kind of together over 3 years, but that's where I really discovered that I wanted to do music. So no more sciences for me, but I enjoy it. But yeah, it was a lot of work. But anyways, I really discovered a lot of music, guitar music over there, because my teacher was really open. It was a classical guitar teacher, but he was really listening to many things, all fingerstyle stuff, like Leo Kottke, Pierre Bensusan, Michael Hedges, and Don Ross. And then one day he lent me a cassette of Don Ross. It was actually like a copied cassette, like
a bootleg.
Yeah. And then I listened to it. I was like, wow, how is this guy can do that on a guitar? It was like, and back in the day, there were no YouTube videos or anything. It was like in 97 or 98. I wanted to learn that stuff. So I started to find materials like VHS cassette of, classes that Don Ross would do. And I could see this, how he was achieving those sounds. Started learning his songs. And that's mostly how I got into that, is really true. Learning a lot of Don Ross tunes. So he's kind of my mentor, I guess.
He's played in here too.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, he's such a great guy. And then over the years, I've been lucky enough to also open for him or play shows with him and on the road. So he's been always a big influence.
He's an influence, but what I really like about your music is that you're not a direct copy of him. You've taken what he does and you've absorbed it into yourself and into your own music and created your own sound,
Thank you. I try. I mean, I've been always taking a little bit here and there. So there's, of course, Don Ross is like the one that really, put me on a certain track. But after that, I also discovered many other players. Like, I really love Stephen Bennett, which is a wonderful writer. He writes, like, unbelievable melodies. Michael Hedges, Leo Kottke, all that stuff. Really, I learned a little bit here, a little bit there. And just to have tools, just to build up my bag of tools.
Mentioned something I think really important, and that's melody. And sometimes when I hear fingerstyle guitar players, it's a lot of technique, but there isn't a lot of melody. There's not something that my ear can hang on to. And I think that's something that you do so well. I think maybe that's one of the reasons I like your playing so much, is that there is a through line, a melody that I can follow.
Well, thank you. Because it's yeah, that's something very important, I think, and especially in instrumental guitar music, because it's already instrumental, so people are not used to listen to that so much. They listen to the voice all the time, so they're not like trained to listen to instrumental music, and especially guitar. So it could be just a background music, but if you give them like elements that they can grab, like a good melody, a rhythm, built like a song that they would hear differently. Like what I like to do is to work, if I was a band, like I have a bass player, a drummer, a keyboard player, and a singer. So that's kind of what I'm trying to emulate. So and use structures that people could follow and, you know, grab onto something they know already, kind of in other type of music.
So. Right. Something they'd hear on the radio, that song format. Do you start with a melody when you write, or does it depend?
It depends, yeah, but most of the time, actually not. I have to kind of build on something. So I sometimes like to go with a simple idea, just a riff, a few chords, a rhythm, and I'll probably loop that and maybe record it if I can, and then I will sing on top of that, or I will... sometimes I use a Guitar Pro, which is a software that you can write your music in there, and then it plays it for you. So it's sometimes cool to hear what it does. Sometimes I will use that, and then I will try to sing something, and I will make an arrangement. So I have to find like a good tuning that will work for it, or so I have to try to write all those parts together and learn it and make sure if I can solve problems. You know, trying to find like there's this fingering here, this, that, this, and that. I have to make all those things together. How can I do that? So I need to find solutions. So it's a really problem-solving type of thing.
That's where your science background comes in, of that whole experimenting and trying again and finding it. And
I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good thing, yeah? Maybe.
I wouldn't be surprised. There's some method to it, that where you're trying, you know, as you say, to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. And you have to get through the various pieces of it in order to make it all work.
Yeah. And also, when I started writing, was not like that. I was like more trying stuff and, you know, it was really intuitive, I guess. And okay, let's try. But the more I wrote, the more I was like finding different ways, different approach. And I find like the best for me is if I have nothing, I don't know, if I'm in front of a blank page, I will listen to some music that I like. I'll try to analyze it and find a cool idea, and then build on it, write, sing, and it's gonna work. It's gonna make it eventually, you know. So that's kind of a method I developed for myself. It doesn't mean that it's gonna work for everybody, but for me, I mean, it works.
Well, how did you come to the song we're going to hear next, which is 30 Minutes in London? I'm assuming that was based in some experience that you had.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, the title is kind of evocative, I guess. But I was in England with the International Guitar Night back in, I think it's in 06. We were mostly doing Scotland and a few dates in England. And when you had this last show was in Dartford next to London. And there was this place called the Mick Jagger Center where we were playing. It's full of, you know, there's a lot of images of Mick Jagger, which is, it's okay if you like Mick Jagger. So anyways, but yeah, that was a fun gig there. And then that was the last one. And I was starting writing this riff maybe, I think, the previous day in the hotel room. And then after that, we took a train from Dartford to London. And in London, we stopped for lunch and we had a little bit of time. So we're looking at the time, and we had a good half hour, so why not? So we just decided to visit London in a half hour. So basically it was just to go and jump in the subway, and we went to the Buckingham Palace, and it was like, wow, let's stay there for a minute or two, watch it, check it out, you know, from the outside. And and then, you know, we had to run again to the next subway, and we had to go to the airport finally. So basically that's kind of the story of that. And then I finished the song at home and kind of in that way, you know, created this very, you know, quick jacuzzi riff that people are like, you know,
rushing and
rushing, and then this moment and you can like stop and check stuff and go back into the subway and you know do the rush again. So it's like a little bit of a stop in time. So I guess that's it. That's
okay.
30 Minutes in London.
Well, this is 30 Minutes in London with Antoine Dufour in Lake Effects Performance Studio. Yes, 30 Minutes in London, indeed, or any big city for that matter. It's like it's exactly it. Antoine Dufour in Lake Effects Performance Studio. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
You are at the point in your career where younger players are looking to you for guidance and looking to you for, you know, whether you're teaching them, whether they just want to sit and watch you and pick up things the way you did when you were first learning. How does that feel to kind of have made that transition?
I don't know. That's weird. I would never have imagined that, you know, my life was not necessarily the goal either, but it's just like, wow, it's pretty humbling. It's good. It's nice.
What do you tell young guitarists who come to you? I mean, what are some of the things that you look for in their playing and then talk to them about?
I mean, their own sound, if they have this little thing that they do and they're really good at, like their like collar, if you will, just to keep that, go into that direction, to work hard on that, to have their own signature sound. Also being very musical, like you were talking about the melody, you know, singing more, maybe writing a little more, because a lot of them are just like noodling and finding stuff. It's cool. Sometimes it creates really good ideas. I have nothing against that. I've done that myself, and I do that still sometimes. But, I mean, it has to come to another layer, another level. So sometimes you have to really sit down and write more, sing more, or use other instruments and just to create and then transfer it to the guitar and just to have like an extra dimension. So those people sometimes have this extra work to do. And doing that, you progress as well. Like, I feel I've been getting better at playing just because I was writing this way. That forced me to you know, had those ideas to put together. I could not play it. I had to figure out a way to make it happen. So I have to really, like we were talking about, problem solving. So I think that's something they have to do more. And it, when you start to do that work, it starts to show and become a lot more interesting.
Canadian guitarist Antoine Dufour performing his composition Mother in Lake Effect's performance studio. Our in-studio concert was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Bonnie North and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Susan Bentz this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.